From the American College of Cardiology, this is Dr. Kim Eagle, ACC.org Editor-in-Chief, with this week's Eagle's Eye View. This is your weekly cardiovascular update from ACC.org. In this week's view, I've chosen to review three articles that I think are very relevant to our practice. The first one deals with recommendations for leisure time and competitive sports in patients who have coronary artery disease. This is something we face all the time. Another is a look at the current 0 and 1 hour algorithm for the early diagnosis of myocardial infarction. This was basically an algorithm that was promulgated by the ESC and recently validated in a very nice study, which I think is useful. And then the last one is a very interesting trial looking at should we continue or interrupt direct oral anticoagulants at the time of device surgery, pacemakers or ICDs, for example. It's a trial called Bruise Control Number 2. Great name. So let's start with the athlete who also has coronary artery disease. And this is really a statement from the sports cardiology section of the European Association of Preventive Cardiology. And I thought the article was well done. It was published in the European Heart Journal. And there were several key points that I thought were useful. The first one is obvious, and that is that exercise stress testing is the pivotal test for us to evaluate whether a patient athlete should be able to enter competitive sports. And in general, if the maximal exercise test is normal and the cardiovascular risk factor profile is low, then the presence of relevant CAD is assumed to be unlikely. And usually this situation would allow the patient athlete to participate in whatever they want to do with no restriction. Obviously, always we're thinking about risk factor management, particularly lipids, blood pressure, etc. If a patient has a borderline or equivocal exercise test result, or one that's uninterpretable, then probably additional stress testing with imaging makes sense. This particular panel likes exercise SPECT, but certainly depending on the institutional expertise and the situation, exercise nuclear perfusion or echo may well be used in that circumstance. Obviously, if the exercise test is positive, then many of those patients will be appropriate for either CT angiogram or direct coronary angiography to identify and confirm both the presence and the extent of their coronary disease. And clearly, if it's a CT angiogram and there's the sense of maybe severe disease, then a direct coronary angiogram typically may be appropriate. It is useful to recall that in some studies have suggested that the master athlete doing multiple marathons may have a higher coronary calcium score than an age-matched control group. And this is an interesting finding. And its relevance to kind of sudden death that we see of master-level athletes in some of the marathons is debatable, but may be relevant. Obviously, all patients and athlete patients should be periodically assessed for their risk factors and so on. Now, athletes who are also patients with clinically proven coronary disease, if they're felt to have a low probability for events, functionally active, limited or no symptoms, et cetera, they should be eligible for most sports, including at a competitive level. But there will be exceptions. And this particular panel talks about high-intensity sports like intensive power and or endurance sports, particularly in patients over the age of 60, where you may want to modify your recommendations about restrictions. For individuals who have a coronary anomaly, like a coronary originating from the wrong sinus, if they have an acute angled takeoff from the aorta, particularly if the anomalous course is between the aorta and the pulmonary artery, these patients are felt to be at high risk for exercise-induced sudden death, and they should be discouraged from that type of activity unless they've been corrected. Finally, another point here was interesting that athlete patients who have myocardial bridging generally can participate without problems in both competitive and leisure time sports. However, if they have evidence of major ischemia, then one would want to provide some restrictive language for them. So I thought it was an interesting review of a topic that I deal with pretty often in my clinic, actually. And you may want to read the article. It's really well done. So let's switch gears now. And this is an article published this week in JACC, Prospective Validation of the 0-1 Hour Algorithm for Early Diagnosis of MI. As you know, there is an algorithm that basically says we'll measure high-sensitivity troponins at time 0 and 1 hour after a person presents to the emergency department with chest pain as a way of fast-tracking the diagnosis of MI. This particular study looked at data from two large multi-center diagnostic studies of patients with suspected MI, and they were pooled and then analyzed based on whether the high-sensitivity troponin T or troponin I measurements identified myocardial infarction. And there were actually almost 8,000 patients together in the study. And the primary diagnostic endpoint in this particular analysis was to look at non-STEMI. Patients with STEMI were actually excluded, as were patients on dialysis. So based on the ESC criteria, the high-sensitivity troponin at 0 and 1 hour, 2,400 patients would fall into the rule-out range. And of these, only 5 were ultimately diagnosed with non-STEMI. So this was a very important finding, a negative predictive value of 99.8%. Conversely, of those with high-sensitivity troponin measurements in the rule-in range, there were about 768 patients, or 18%. About 572 ultimately were diagnosed with non-STEMI, so a positive predictive value of about 75%. And whether the troponin was high-sensitivity I or high-sensitivity T, both groups were pretty similar in terms of performance. So the authors of this paper concluded that the triage strategy for non-STEMI using this ESC 0-1 hour algorithm was safe and effective. The perspective of this, of course, is that identifying how to manage patients in the emergency department is a big problem. It's a common problem. It's expensive. And this really is a very large sample. It's almost 8,000 patients. And this validation study really helps to address previous concerns about small numbers of patients, lower numbers of non-STEMI, et cetera. And it certainly highlights the effectiveness of this strategy for at least ruling out non-STEMI within an hour of presentation. I mean, that number, that negative predictive value of 99.8% is very impressive and certainly makes me more confident that this type of quick rule-out strategy will have merit in our practices. Okay, so that's the second article. The third I want to talk about is Bruise Control 2. I mean, cardiologists, aren't we great? We have the best names for our trials. And this was published in the European Heart Journal just this past week. Basically, the question was, should we continue or interrupt direct oral anticoagulants at the time of device surgery in patients with moderate or high risk for arterial thromboembolic events? And the authors randomized patients with atrial fibrillation and a CHADS-VASc score greater than or equal to 2 to either continued or interrupted direct oral anticoagulant with either dabigatran, rivaroxaban, or apixaban. And the primary outcome was blindly evaluated. They were looking for pocket hematoma, especially resulting in reoperation, longer-term interruption of anticoagulation or prolongation of the hospital stay. In the group where the anticoagulant was continued, the median time between pre- and post-operative doses of the anticoagulant was 12 hours, and in the interrupted arm, it was 3 days, 72 hours. And the trial was very, very useful. There were 328 patients in the continued DOAC arm, and only 7 of them, 2.1%, had an endpoint. Similarly, in the interrupted group, there were 334 patients, and only 7 had one of the complications. There was only 1 stroke and 1 pericardial effusion in each arm. So this really suggests that it is reasonable to use either strategy. If a person has a strong fear of bleeding, then the interrupted strategy appears to be safe. if one has a strong fear of arterial thrombosis, thromboembolic events, then the continued approach seems reasonable. And, you know, even though the sample size is, 660 patients, it's big enough that I think if we're going to see a major safety signal either way, that we would have seen it. So I think the bruise control trial is very useful for those of us managing patients who are having pacemakers, defibrillators, and I offer it to you as well. So this has been Kim Eagle with your Eagle's Eye View, your cardiovascular update from ACC.org. All of this information can be found on the website. Find us online or wherever you get your podcasts. And until next week, I hope you have a good one. Thank you.